Chapter 2
"Good morning to you," said Stephen. "My name is Maturin, and I have an appointment with Sir Joseph Blaine."
"Good morning, sir," replied the porter. "Pray be so good as to take a seat. James, show the gentleman into the second waiting room."
This was not that famous place, looking out over the court and so through the screen into Whitehall, in which generation after generation of naval officers had waited, usually in the hope of promotion or at any rate of an appointment to a ship, but a far smaller, far more discreet little room with only one chair in it, and Stephen had barely had time to sit down before the inner door opened. Sir Joseph, a portly man with a pale, glabrous and usually anxious, work-worn face, hurried in, smiling, looking thoroughly pleased. He took both Stephen's hands, crying,
"Why, Stephen, how very, very happy I am to see you! How are you, my dear sir? How do you do after all these countless miles and days?"
"Very well, I thank you, dear Joseph, but I wish I could see you less pale and harried and overworked. Do you sleep? Do you eat at all?"
"Sleep is difficult, I must confess. Yet I still eat tolerably well. Will you join me this evening at Black's? Do join me, and you will see. I always sup on a boiled fowl with oyster sauce and a pint of our claret."
"I shall happily watch you," said Stephen, "but for my own part I have already bespoke turbot and a bottle of Sillery." He felt in his pocket and went on, "Pray accept this offering." He passed over a dirty handkerchief, and eagerly unwrapping it, Sir Joseph cried,
"You Pater Ingens! How very kind of you to remember! A splendid specimen indeed! Such generosity! I wonder how you can bear to part with him."
He set the creature down, gazed at it, and murmured,
"So now at last I am the possessor of the noblest beetle in creation."
The door opened again, and a severely official face said,
"The gentlemen are beginning to arrive, Sir Joseph."
"Thank you, Mr. Heller," said Sir Joseph. "I shall be with them before the striking of the clock."
The door closed.
"The committee, of course," he said to Stephen.
He wrapped the beetle very carefully in his own handkerchief, gave back the first, and went on,
"Now I must speak to you as a public servant. The First Lord bids me tell you that a small squadron is intended for Captain Aubrey. He is to hoist a broad pennant and cruise off the west coast of Africa to protect our merchantmen and discourage the slave trade. The slavers are of many nationalities. They carry a large variety of protections, and they may be accompanied by men of war, so clearly he needs not only an eminent surgeon, but also a linguist, and a man steeped in political intelligence. And it is hoped that these characters may be united in the same amiable person. Yet there is the possibility of certain eventualities, and since I know that, without its affecting our friendship in any way, there are subjects on which we are not wholly in agreement, I think it proper to ask, if I may, where your heart would lie if the French intended another descent on Ireland. Believe me, this is a question primarily designed to preserve you from the possibility of a painful state of indecision and reserve."
"No indecision at all, my dear. I should do everything in my power to take, sink, burn, or destroy them. The French, with their present horrible system, would be utterly intolerable in Ireland. Look at Switzerland. Look at the Italian states. No, no, no. As you are aware, I do very strongly feel that each nation should govern itself. It may be said that the Irish have not been very good at it. The annals maketh the saddest reading in the world, and an O'Brien, no less, Tullow O'Brien, King of Tumund, sacked Clonmacnoise itself. But that is not really to the point. My own house may be unswept in places, but it is my own, and I will thank no stranger for putting it in order, least of all if he is an ugly, false, impious thief of a black Corsican."
"Thank you, Stephen," said Sir Joseph, shaking his hand. "I did so hope that that was what you would say. Now we must go and meet the committee."
"You know what I have to tell them, sure?"
"Yes, yes. I feel for you extremely."
It was clear from the atmosphere of the committee meeting that its other members were also aware of his mission's outcome. Indeed, in its broadest outlines, the outcome was perfectly obvious, since Peru was still part of the Spanish Empire. But he nevertheless gave them a succinct account, to which most of them listened intelligently, asking a few pertinent questions in the course of his narrative, and rather more when he had finished. After he had dealt with the points they raised, Mr. Preston of the Foreign Office, who had been taking notes throughout, said,
"Dr. Maturin,
May I beg you to listen to this very brief summary I've been making for the minister and to correct any mistakes I may have committed?"
Stephen bowed and Preston went on.
"Dr. Maturin, appearing before the committee, stated that after the ship in which he was travelling, a hired vessel, his own property, duly licensed as a letter of marque, had left Sydney Cove, her commander received instructions to proceed to Muahu, where two or perhaps three rival factions were at war. He was to ally himself with the most amenable, ensure his supremacy, and annex the island before pursuing his course for South America. This was accomplished, and shortly afterwards an American privateer was captured."
"Forgive me, sir, if I interrupt you at this point," said Stephen. "I am afraid I must have expressed myself badly. The ship in question, the ship in which I was then embarked, was the Nutmeg of Consolation, not my Surprise, which we met by appointment off the Salibabu Passage, and in which we sailed on to Peru. The Nutmeg was provided by the Governor of Java to replace the frigate Diane, in which the late Mr. Fox and I had the happiness of concluding a treaty with the Sultan of Pulo Prabang." There was a general murmur of approval at this, and Mr. Preston looked at Stephen with an unofficial and even affectionate smile. "And the conflict in Muahu was between the island's legitimate queen and a discontented chief, aided by some white mercenaries and a Frenchman called Dutour, a wealthy visionary who wished to set up a democratic paradise at the cost of slaughtering those who disagreed with him, and who had bought, armed and manned, a ship in America to effect this purpose. In this case, morality and expediency happily coincided. The Nutmeg defeated the discontented chief and captured both Dutour and his ship, but there was no question of annexation. The Queen entered into an alliance with King George III, gratefully accepting his protection, no more. And as for the American privateer, the Franklin, as Monsieur Dutour called her, it appeared that she did not in fact enjoy that status, Dutour having omitted to take out letters of marque, so that his capturing British whalers made a pirate of him. This, at all events, was the opinion of the Surprise's commander, who decided to carry him back to England so that the question might be settled by the proper judges."
"Thank you, sir. I shall make all this clear," said Mr. Preston, writing fast.
Then he went on with his abstract, dealing with Stephen's encounter with a resident agent in Lima, his very successful conversation with high ecclesiastics and military men, particularly General Hurtado, all of them committed to independence and many to the abolition of slavery. The escape of the captured Dutour, his contacts with the French mission engaged on a similar but much less successful, much less well-funded errand, his denunciation of Stephen as a British agent, and the cry of foreign gold raised by the opponents of independence, a cry which, taken up by the hired mobs, made Stephen's exactly timed scheme, based on the temporary absence of the Viceroy, quite impossible, since General Hurtado refused to act, and Hurtado alone could move the necessary troops.
"It must have been the cruelest blow," observed Colonel Warren, the head of Army Intelligence.
"It was indeed," said Stephen.
"Had Dutour any reason to suppose that you were, in fact, a British agent?" asked another member.
"He had not, but I was obliged to speak French when I was treating his wounded men after they had been captured. Presently he almost certainly remembered meeting me in Paris, and intuition, coupled with very strong personal dislike, and a desire to do harm, no doubt did the rest. It was an accusation that would have passed unnoticed, disregarded in any other climate. But once the anti-independentists had seized upon it, public opinion changed entirely."
After a silence, the representative of the Treasury said,
"It is my duty to observe that very large sums of money in various forms were placed at Dr. Maturin's disposal, and to ask him whether it was possible to preserve any part, such as the easily transportable drafts and bonds, that had not yet been exchanged."
"It is not without a certain complacency that I can tell the gentleman," said Stephen, "that the gold, which was to have been parcelled out among the various regiments on Wednesday, had Hurtado not cried off on Tuesday, remains, apart from a few £100 worth of douceurs, in the hands of our agent in Lima, while the paper obligations, bonds and the like, are now aboard the little vessel that brought me up to the pool, in a case under the immediate eye of her captain." Certain members of the committee were unable to conceal a look of intense satisfaction, and Stephen perceived that some other costly scheme would now once more be possible. He added, "As for the gold, our agent in Peru is of opinion, and I entirely agree with him, for what my view is worth, that it would be far more usefully employed in the Kingdom of Chile, where Don Bernardo O'Higgins had such a following. Finally, I may observe that our agent has shipping interests and can undertake to remove the cumbrous metal.
Speaking of cumbrous metal, said Blaine as they walked down Whitehall together, you could do me such a kindness if you mean to return to Shelmerston in the tender, and with this brisk wind settled in the northeast, she would carry you there quicker and in much more comfort than a coach. No changing, either.
Please to name the service in question.
It is the carrying of a statue I have promised a friend in Weymouth. An impossible object for a wagon, but a mere trifle for a ship.
Stephen, extremely unwilling not to post straight down to Barham and Diana, stopped a passing hackney coach, and with his hand on the door handle he said, "What would it weigh at all? This is only a very little, small, thin, sharp-bodied vessel."
"In the nature of 3 ton, I suppose. A little, small, thin porphyry, Jove."
"Listen, my dear, may I say by all means, very happy, unless Captain Pullings says it must necessarily plunge through the schooner's bottom. I'm on my way to see Mrs. Broad in the Liberties of the Savoy. You remember Mrs. Broad of the Grapes?"
"Certainly. My best compliments to her, if you please."
"And from the Grapes it is no distance at all to the pool."
"Until this evening, then," called Blaine,
withdrawing hastily to the wall as a coach and four came cantering up, spraying filth wide on either hand. Mrs. Broad and Stephen were old friends. He kept a room up one pair of stairs the year round, even when he was in another hemisphere. He had a cupboard for his skeletons and presses for all manner of things that he might need. Instruments, specimens, books, the unfinished manuscript of a work in lithotomy, a large number of old letters and used envelopes with notes on the back, when he was in London, and she was thoroughly used to his ways, as well as Padine's, who acted as his servant on shore, wearing breeches with silver buckles, of which he was inordinately, sinfully proud. She had known the doctor for so long, and in such difficult circumstances, that nothing surprised her very much. It had been bears in the coal-hole and laundry before now, and badgers rescued from a baiting in the farther outhouse, as well as some very odd dissections indeed, and the suggestion of 2 little girls did not worry her particularly, however black and popish they might be. She wept to hear how and why they had been taken from their native island, but having wiped her eyes she comforted Stephen's apprehensions by saying,
"Lord bless you, Doctor, they will be happy enough here. We have every colour in the Liberties, black, grey, brown and yellow, everything except perhaps bright blue, and they can run about in the churchyard or watch the traffic in the Strand. But, oh dear me, sir, what will you think of me? I've never asked after Mrs. Maturin. How did your good lady do, sir? And Miss Bridget, bless her?"
"I have not seen them yet, Mrs. Broad. I had to come straight up from the chops of the channel in the tender while Captain Aubrey went ashore. But I may go down in the tender tomorrow. The wind sits perfectly. Or I may take a chaise."
"Well, at least you will have supper here and sleep in your room. Lucy and I have been airing it ever since Padine came and made us understand you was not far off. Claw, claw, claw," he said, the way he had, poor fellow. "And seeing me look stupid, Lucy cried, 'He means the doctor is near at hand,' and we all laughed. Oh, dear me, how we laughed. And we put warm lavendered sheets on the bed."
"Sup I cannot, Mrs. Broad, for I am pledged to Sir Joseph Blaine, who sends you his compliments, but sleep I will most happily. It would be best to give me the front door key, for I may be late. But now I must run down to the pool." He walked into Black's, and there was Blaine standing in front of the hall fire, with his coat tails over his elbows and his bottom exposed to the blaze. "Captain Pullings says she can very well manage 3 tons, said Stephen, "but since he must sail on the turn of the tide, he wonders very much how you will get your image aboard in time."
"Oh, what capital news! There will be no difficulty whatsoever, since it is already at Somerset House, and we have an ordnance barge that will bring it alongside in a trice. In a trice. Stephen, ain't you clemmed? This northeaster makes me so hungry that I should be pettish if it were anyone but you."
"I am of your way of thinking entirely. Let us go up at once." They ate eagerly, almost in silence for some time, like old table companions.
"Come, that is better," said Sir Joseph, putting some of his fowl's bones on a side plate. "Now I am more nearly human, though by no means satisfied yet. I shall certainly eat a Welsh rabbit and probably a good many pettifors with my coffee. How did you find Mrs. Broad?"
"Blooming, I thank you, and she sends her duty. She is a very good creature, you know."
"I am sure of it."
"We brought back 2 little girls, Sarah and Emily, from a Melanesian island where all the people but for them had been destroyed by the smallpox caught from a passing whaler. They could not be left there to die slowly. They were already very much reduced, so I took them on board. Perhaps it would have been kinder to knock them on the head directly.
"It is said that one must beware of pity," observed Sir Joseph.
At the time it seemed to me that there was no choice, but since then it has puzzled me exactly to know what to do with them. I should like them to be brought up understanding how a house is run, but not as servants, to have reasonable dowries.
"Dowries? For my infinite good luck, your fortune is intact," said Blaine with a laugh, since at the very beginning of this prodigious voyage an exasperated Stephen had sent him a letter with a power of attorney, begging him to transfer his wealth from the huge, slow, impersonal, negligent but solvent London house that looked after it to a small country bank that ceased payment a few months later, the depositors getting fourpence in the pound, a letter that in his agitation he had failed to sign with anything but his Christian name. This omission rendered the power of attorney invalid, but it accounted firstly for Blaine's and Maturin's most unusual custom of calling one another Stephen and Joseph, and secondly for Stephen's still being a man of uncommon substance. "And as I remember, it was nearly all in gold," Blaine continued.
"So it was, and so it is, for the greater part, still in my godfather's iron-bound chests. I changed only a small proportion for current expenses. Reasonable dowries, then, in case they choose to marry rather than lead apes in hell.
To marry, perhaps, some skilled and thinking artisan, a clockmaker, for example, or one that makes scientific instruments, possibly an apothecary or a surgeon or a preparer of specimens for anatomy classes. Catholic, of course, certainly not a sailor. A sailor who may be absent for years throws impossible strains on his wife. If she is a woman of any degree of temperament at all, there is, of course, the question of chastity, and in either case there is that of command, or perhaps I should say, of decision. A woman who has been running a household, perhaps an estate, acquires an authority and a power of decision that she is not always willing to renounce, nor indeed should she always do so, since men are not invariably born with innate financial wisdom, and those who have spent most of their time at sea may be far less well acquainted with business by land than a sensible woman. Then again there is the bringing up of children." Stephen prosed away until he noticed that Sir Joseph's attention was almost entirely taken up with his Welsh rabbit, and perhaps with some anxieties that he had brought away with him from the Admiralty. He stopped, and in the silence Blaine said,
"Very true. There is little to be said for the marriage of a sailor, or for any other man if it come to that. As for the perpetuation of the human race, there are times when it seems to me that the world would be far, far better if the race were to die out. We have made such a sorry piece of work of it. Everything for happiness, and misery everywhere. Even in spite of my boiled fowl and my pint of claret and your company, I find my spirits much oppressed."
He glanced round the room, still well filled with members, some of them at tables quite close, and said,
"But of course I speak as a bachelor, and it suddenly comes to me that you are now a married man. It was inhuman of me to delay you with my porphyry Jove. Of course you did not land in Shelmiston and post away into Hampshire with Jack Aubrey, so of course you have not seen Diana, or had any news of her, or of Mrs. Oakes?"
"I have not," replied Stephen, wondering a little at Blaine's emphasis.
"Shall we take our coffee in the library?"
"By all means. It is the finest room in the club."
Fine and even splendid it was, but its three great lustres shone upon books, comfortable chairs, and Turkey carpet alone. Never a member there.
"Stephen,"
said Joseph, when the waiter had left them with a pot of coffee, a tray of petit fours, and a decanter of cognac,
"I did not think it right to tell you what is in my mind in a public office, however closed the room. These hypothetical ears may be no more than one of the hallucinations of a mind too long and too closely engaged on what, for lack of a better word, I shall call intelligence. But they may exist, and that is why I am so happy that we are sitting together here in this warm and well-padded desert."
He poured coffee and absent-mindedly ate half a dozen little meringues.
"Your private letter asked me to take care of Clarissa Oakes, and told me about her exceptional fund of information."
Clarissa, a young gentlewoman reduced to beggary, had worked in a fashionable brothel within a musket shot of the clubs in St. James's Street, where she was well placed for learning a great many curious facts.
"I did take care of her, getting poor young Oakes his promotion and a ship. And when he was killed, I took her down to Diana.
Her fund of information was indeed exceptional, and with her help we quickly identified the limping gentleman with the garter who was connected with those wicked buggers, Ray and Ledward. The wicked buggers, and Blaine used the gross word literally, had been concerned with passing secret intelligence, particularly naval intelligence, to the enemy. They had been betrayed by a French agent, and after many changes of fortune, Stephen had cut them both to pieces in an East Indian dissecting room.
Unhappily, he turned out to be a hemi-demi-royal, the Duke of Habakstal. He was brought up mainly in England, but he has a little principality close to Hanover, and a much larger estate on the Rhine, both now occupied by the French, of course, and ideally suited for French blackmail. The old king was very fond of him, and if he had been a marrying man, which he is not, he might perhaps have had one of our princesses. But even without, he is very nearly untouchable.
If I do not mistake, he has high army rank, perhaps only honorary, and considerable influence.
Yes, he acts as adviser to several bodies, and through his aide-de-camp, Colonel Blagden, he may be said to sit on some important committees.
A pause, in which they both drank brandy, and then Blaine went on,
"Of course there was no possibility of direct proceedings against him without absolutely cast-iron evidence like that we had against Ledward and Ray, and this we do not possess. However, we did make a good deal of distant thunder. You would never believe, Stephen, what Byzantine ways Whitehall possesses of conveying a threat, of causing it to echo from wall to wall until it reaches the intended ear."
What effect did it have?
Excellent, to begin with. Information had been going across, as in Ledward's time, and it stopped abruptly. But presently our gentleman came to a better understanding of his own impunity, and last month we lost the greater part of a West Indies convoy. More than that, he is a very old court and ministry hand, and I believe he has traced the threat back to its source, or is near to doing so. I am afraid of his resentment, both for myself and you. He was very much attached to Ledward, and even, in their strange fashion, to Ray. He is a bitterly revengeful man. I am by no means sure of all this, Stephen, but there are one or two things that increase my feeling of uneasiness, however weak, illogical, and even superstitious it may be. One is that both Montague and his cousin St. Ledger seem to be fighting shy of me, as I dare say you noticed at the committee, when I—
A member in a bright blue coat with shining buttons walked in. He peered myopically at them, came a little nearer, and called out,
"Sir Joseph, you have not seen Edward Cadogan by any chance?"
"No, sir, I have not," said Blaine.
"Then I shall have to look in the billiard room."
The door closed behind him, and Blaine poured more brandy.
"Then again, you will remember you asked me to arrange pardons for both Mrs. Oakes and your Padine for the crime of returning from Botany Bay without leave. It seemed to me a matter of no difficulty. Clarissa is the widow of a sea officer killed in a very creditable action, and in the right quarters I could mention unusual services rendered to intelligence. While your interest with the Admiralty and some of your more illustrious patients would surely cover poor Padine. But my unofficial approaches have not been satisfactory. Strange delays, a hint of unavowed reluctance. I do not like to press a direct request, still less present it in writing, until I am sure of a favourable response. I had thought of abandoning the usual channels and applying to the Duke of Sussex, seeing that you and he are both fellows of the Royal Society and founder members of the Council Against Slavery. But he has gone to Lisbon, and the first stages in a matter of this kind must be by word of mouth.
Certainly, said Stephen.
In any event, said Blaine, after a pause for consideration, this second instance is no more than academic. If the two in question do not advertise their presence, the likelihood of their being disturbed is utterly remote, and I cite their case only as an example of the tainting effect of an important man's dislike. If he has made his aversion evident, if he has cried, "That old fool Blaine at the Admiralty," let us say, the news would spread. I should become at least slightly leprous, and no man in his senses would hurry to do me a favour. That is all. I do not intend to imply any direct malignity, extending beyond me and perhaps you, if indeed that malignity exists at all, and is not the figment of a fagged-out mind and an overwrought imagination.
Stephen took out a soft pouch made of llama skin. These are the leaves of Erythroxylon coca, the cuca or coca shrub, he said. I have used them for a great while, and so have most of the inhabitants of Peru.
If you roll them into a moderate ball in your mouth, then add a little of this lime and so thrust it into your cheek, chewing gently from time to time, you will experience first an agreeable warm tingling of your tongue, the inner lining of your cheeks, and the border of your larynx, followed by an increasingly remarkable and evident clarity of mind, a serenity, and a perception that almost all worries are of little real consequence, most of them being the result of confused, anxious, and generally fallacious notions that crowd and increase in direct proportion to the decline of pure single-minded reason. I should not advise the taking of it now if you value your night's sleep, since it tends to keep one awake, but do try it in the morning. It is the most virtuous of leaves.
If it diminishes anxiety by even 0.5%, pray let me have it at once, said Blaine. The Dutch Duke is not the least of my cares, but he is much outweighed in real importance by the situation in the Adriatic and in Malta once again, to say nothing of the present crisis in the Levant.
The Ringle stood in to Shelmerston on the very last breath of the expiring northeast breeze, crossed the bar and dropped anchor inside the Surprise, whose thin crew of shipkeepers greeted her with the expected cries.
"Where have they been? What have they been a-doing of? Bowsing up their jibs, no doubt. The slow coach could have come down quicker. The wagon would have beat them by 30 minutes.
Stephen, Tom Pullings, Sarah, Emily, and Padine hurried ashore, piled into two chaises, and set off directly for Ashgrove. But in spite of all their haste, express letters, signals, and orders travelling by semaphore from the Admiralty roof to Portsmouth had preceded them, and it was with the third of these in her hand that Mrs. Williams, a short, thick, red-faced woman, now redder than usual with excitement, said to her daughter Sophie Aubrey,
"The Ringle passed Portland Bill at 4:30, so Dr. Maturin is sure to be here this afternoon. I think it my duty, and Mrs. Morris agrees with me, to tell Captain Aubrey the whole of Diana's disgraceful misconduct, so that he may break it gently to his friend."
"Mamma," said Sophie firmly, "I beg you will do no such thing. You know he is to lie quiet, and Dr. Gowers said—"
"Dr. Gowers, ma'am, if you please," said the butler.
"Good morning, ladies," said Gowers. "I will just have a look at the captain, if you please, and then we can attend to the children." "He is as well as can be expected," he said, coming down the stairs, "but he must be kept perfectly quiet, with the room still darkened, and perhaps he could be read to in a low voice. Blair's sermons or Young's night thoughts would answer very well. There's been far too much mental agitation recently, and he is to take 3 of these drops in a little water every hour. Soup this evening, not too thick, and perhaps a little cheese. No beef or mutton, of course."
He and Sophie hurried away to Charlotte, Fanny, and George, who immediately upon their hasty arrival from Dorset had seen fit to come down with a high fever, a noisy cough, headache, restlessness, thirst, and a tendency to complain. When they had gone, Mrs. Williams walked softly into her son-in-law's room, sat by his bed, and asked him how he did. Having heard that he was pretty well, and that he looked forward to seeing Stephen Maturin, she coughed, drew her chair nearer, and said,
"Captain, in order that you should be able to break the dreadful news gradually and gently to your poor unfortunate friend, I think it my duty to tell you that since the birth of this idiot child, Diana has been drinking heavily. She has been driving about the countryside, dining with people as far as 20 miles away, sometimes fast, raffish people like the Willises, frequently going to balls and ridottos in Portsmouth, and perpetually fox-hunting, sometimes without even a groom to accompany her. She's no sort of a mother to the poor little girl, and if it were not for her friend, this Mrs. Oakes, the child would be left entirely to the care of the servants. And worse still," she said, lowering her voice, "worse still, Mr. Aubrey, I say this of my own niece with the greatest reluctance, as you can imagine, worse still, there are doubts about her conduct. I say doubts, but among others Colonel Hoskins has been frequently mentioned, and Mrs. Hoskins no longer returns Diana's calls. Mrs. Morris says—" "But here she is. Come in, Selina, dear."
"Oh, Captain Aubrey, I am afraid I have sad news for you,"
cried Selina Morris. "But I think you ought to know. I think it's only right to tell you. It is only too easy to nourish a viper in one's bosom. Just now, on information received from our man Frederick Briggs, I caught preserved killick making off by the back lane to the servants' quarters with a hamper of wine. Where did you get that hamper of wine, killick? I asked him, and in his rough, bold way, without so much as a ma'am, he replied, which the captain gave at me, and walked doggedly on. I called out that I should report him this minute, and hurried to be here before the hamper could be concealed or huddled back into the cellar. I'm quite out of breath, I declare.
That was very kind of you, Mrs. Morris, said Jack, but in fact I did give him the hamper.
Oh, indeed. Well, my intention was good, I am sure, and I ran all the way. My father had no notion of giving...
But feeling that the notions of her father were of no great consequence in this case, although he was a peer, she withdrew, making discontented motions with her shoulders, arms, buttocks.
But as I was saying before dear Selina came on her mistaken but very well-meant errand, the greatest cause for general comment and disapproval was Diana's almost open, what shall I call it, liaison with Mr. Wilson, who managed her stud, a most improper occupation for a woman, even a married woman, by the way, a fine upstanding man with red whiskers, though not to compare with Selina's Briggs, who lived, if not in the same house, then at least very close and in an isolated part of the country. When last I saw her, which is now some time ago, since I never fail to speak my mind to my niece, which instead of attending to admonitions she resents, she always was a most undutiful girl.
But you told me yourself that she provided the capital for your present concern.
Perhaps she did, but the money meant nothing to her. Quite apart from her enormous winnings, Dr. M. left her far, far too much at her own uncontrolled, unsupervised disposal. And in any case, Selina and I will pay it back presently. However, last time we saw her, Mrs. Morris was certain that she was with child, and now we hear that the horses are all sent up to London, that the grooms are turned away, and that she has gone off herself, no doubt with her handsome manager. You must break it gently to your poor friend, or he will run mad.
I shall certainly do nothing of the kind.
Jack's silence had quite persuaded Mrs. Williams that he was in full agreement.
Upon my word! She cried in her indignation. Then I shall do it myself.
If you presume to speak to him on this subject, said Jack, in a low tone that nevertheless carried full conviction, you and Mrs. Morris and your servant Briggs will leave this house within the hour.
Mrs. Williams had changed much during his absence, but not so much that she could bring herself to renounce free board and lodging in a comfortable house whenever she chose to claim it. She closed her lips tight, and pale with anger, left the room with much the same gestures as her friend. Jack lay back. He was far too happy to be angry for long. He had already heard a great deal of what she said about Diana. During the voyage, Sophie's letters, far spaced out though they were, had kept him aware of the general situation, and although he knew that Diana's views on sexual morality were rather like his own, he did not believe a tenth part of this gossip. Particularly, he did not believe that she had run off with the man who managed her stud. And although he did very much regret Stephen's inevitable, heavy, heavy disappointment over the daughter he had so looked forward to, he felt that the marriage itself would hold together. It had always done so hitherto, in spite of being subjected to extraordinary strains. Happiness and grief were both active in his mind, and partly to escape the confusion, as well as the guilt of joy at such a time, he deliberately reflected on the change in Mrs. Williams. Diana, like many of her friends, had always been willing to back her judgment of a horse with a bet, and having staked a large sum at 35-1 on the animal that won the St. Leger 2 years ago, she found herself with several thousand to spare. Part of her stake had been made up of small amounts, like the cook's half-guinea, rising to 25 for old Lady West, whose husband, like Diana's father, had been a cavalry officer. But most had been the 5-guinea bets laid by tolerably well-to-do widow ladies in Bath, who delighted in gambling, sums that the big, reliable London offices would not trouble with, while the small local men, sad riff-raff, could not be trusted. When she had paid all these happy creatures, she suggested that her aunt, at that time penniless and oh so meek, should take over the whole undertaking, but for a profit, being her own betting office. Here was the connection, ready at hand, and Diana would show her how to keep a book. Just where the Honourable Mrs. Morris came in, he could not recollect, but she added much to the respectability of the concern, while her servant, a tall man in a black coat who looked like a dissenting minister and who expected other servants to call him Mr. Briggs, had been employed by a racehorse owner and was very well acquainted with the subject. The two ladies' conversation could never have recommended them anywhere, but they were accepted members of that world, and their respectability, combined with reliability, discretion, and convenience, caused their undertaking to prosper. How Mrs. Williams reconciled her occupation with her former rigid principles, Jack could not tell, but the principles had never prevented her, in the days of her wealth, from making an eager search for investments that would give her a very high yield. An attorney who offered her a certain 31% return had been her undoing, and perhaps it was all part of the same thing. At all events, she now grew steadily richer and steadily more unpleasant. Jack was revolving this in his mind, an aphorism just out of reach, when he heard the sound of wheels on the drive, the opening and closing of carriage doors, steps on the gravel, more voices raised quite high, steps in the corridor, and Stephen opened the door of the room in which Jack's bed had been set up. "Why, my poor Jack!" he exclaimed, but in little more than a whisper. "How sorry I am to see you brought so low, my dear. Do your ears and eyes hurt you now? Can you bear talking at all?"
"To be sure I can, Stephen," said Jack, quite loud. "It is much better today, and I am so glad to see you. But as for my being brought low, it is only my head. My heart is bounding about like a lamb. I had such a signal on Wednesday morning, brought up post-haste from the Port Admiral, that valuable man. Such a signal. But tell me, how did your journey go? Was all well in town?"
"Very well, I thank you. Sir Joseph asked me to bring a statue down for a friend at Weymouth, so I came back with Tom in the Ringle, picking Sarah and Emily up at Chelmerston and coming on by chaise. Tom came along with us for orders. You can hear him roaring on the terrace. I mean to take the girls on to Barham to see Diana for a while, and then to carry them up to the Grapes to live with Mrs. Broad. But, Jack, your house is in a strange turmoil, I find. Will I go and bid Tom bring up all standing?"
"Never in life. I'm sorry for the din. That screeching is Sophie from upstairs, I think, talking to him. But the fact of the matter is, the children have reported sick, the three of them, and with me laid up, the place is all a-who. Would you like to hear about my signal, Stephen?"
"If you please."
"Well, I am to have the Bellona, 74, with a broad pennant, and Tom as captain under me, Terrible, another 74, and three frigates, one of which is sure to be the Pyramus, and perhaps half a dozen sloops for the cruise off Africa that Heneage Dundas told me of. Ain't you amazed? I was, I promise you. I thought it was just one of those things people throw out, far too good to be true."
"I give you all the joy in the world of your command, my dear. Long, long may it prosper."
"You will come with me, Stephen, will you not? It is mostly for putting down the slave trade, you remember, and by the 25th of next month all should be assembled, manned, and equipped."
"I should be very happy. But now, my dear Commodore, I must go and look at your children. I promised poor distracted Sophie so to do while your medical man was there, so that we might lay our physical heads together. I also promised not to tire you. Then I must hurry on to Barham. If I'm not there by dark, Diana will think we have been overturned in some remote, ill-favoured ditch." Jack's spirits fell at once. He hesitated and said,
"It is quite a while since Sophie has seen her. Some disagreement with Diana's aunt, I believe. But, Stephen, do not be disappointed if she is away. Nobody knew we were coming back, you know."
Stephen smiled and said, "Diana and I will come and see you on your feet in a few days' time, I hope. But in the meanwhile I shall desire Dr. Gowers to prescribe a little hellebore to calm the turbulence of your spirits and procure a healing equanimity. God bless now." In the hall he found Tom Pullings, entirely alone, leaping and making antic gestures. On hearing Stephen, he span round, showing a face of such laughing delight that the devil himself could not have failed to smile.
"Can I see the captain now, do you think?" he said.
"You may, but do not speak loud. Do not agitate his mind."
Pullings took his elbow in an iron grip and whispered, "He is to hoist a broad pennant in Bellona, and he has named me to be captain under him. He has made me post. I'm a post captain. I never thought it could happen."
Stephen shook his hand and said, "I am so happy. At this rate, Tom, I shall live to congratulate you on your flag."
"Thank you. Thank you, sir," called Tom after him as he hurried up the stairs. "I've never heard a sentiment so well expressed, nor with such elegance and wit neither."
"Sophie, my love," said Stephen, kissing her on both cheeks. "You are in the most charming bloom, Joy. But there is some degree of nervous tension, even a hint of febrility. I believe, Dr. Gowers, that we might profitably exhibit a modest dose of hellebore for Mrs. Aubrey as well as for the Commodore."
"The Commodore?" murmured Sophie, squeezing his arm.
They looked at the children, all struck dumb for the moment, and presently Stephen said,
"I quite agree with my colleague. This is an advanced state of the commencement of measles. Look at the swollen, bloated appearance of poor Charlotte's face."
"I'm not Charlotte. I'm Fanny. My face is neither swollen nor bloated."
"Oh, Fanny, for shame," cried her mother in great distress, tears starting from her eyes. "So bloated and so swollen that the eruption cannot be long delayed. But I am sorry that it should be the measles, since I cannot bring my little girls up to see the invalids. Like many other black people, they have no protection against the disease and frequently succumb. And now, dear Sophie, I must go and collect them. Do not move, I beg."
And privately in her ear, "I am so very happy about Jack." On the stairs he murmured to himself, "Presently I shall see a little face that is neither swollen nor bloated, one that is incapable of such a gross reply." In the drawing-room he found no one but Mrs. Williams, still simmering with ill temper.
"Where are Sarah and Emily?" he asked.
"The little niggers! I sent them to the kitchen where they belong," said Mrs. Williams. "When I came in, they neither curtsied nor called me ma'am, and when I said, 'Don't you know you must not just say good day and no more, as if you were addressing the cat, and don't you know you must curtsy to a gentlewoman?' they only looked at one another and shook their heads."
"You are to consider, ma'am," said Stephen, "that they have spent much of their life aboard a man of war, where there are no gentlewomen to be addressed, and where curtsies, if they exist, are reserved for officers."
Mrs. Williams sniffed, and then said,
"They are your property, I collect, and if so I must inform you that no slaves can be countenanced in England, so that you are likely to lose your price. In the colonies, yes, but we must always remember that England is a free country, and that as soon as slaves set foot on English soil they too are free. As a foreigner you cannot, of course, understand our love of liberty, but we must never forget to look closely at all sides of a bargain, or we may find ourselves buying a mare's nest."
Ill nature and ill temper urged her to add something about charity beginning at home, since a moment's reflection on their clothes and uncowed manners suggested that they might be protégés rather than bond servants. But angry though she was, she did not dare go farther, and after contemplating her for a moment with his pale eyes, Stephen took up his hat, bowed, said, "Servant, ma'am," and hurried off to the kitchen, where he found the little girls telling two superannuated ship's cooks about the glories of the green ice they had seen off the Horn. For the rest of the journey they were very quiet, gazing at the wonderfully unfamiliar English countryside in the gentle evening light. So was Stephen. His mind, like Jack's, was confused by a variety of strong emotions, intense anticipation and a dread he did not choose to name, and like Jack he took refuge in reflecting upon Mrs. Williams. There was not only the change from the broken-spirited, poor relation, perpetually aware of her dependence, back to her former degree of assurance, though not indeed of dominance, Sophie had grown much stronger, and of indignant self-righteousness, there was also a change in that earlier being, with a barely definable raffishness superadded, an ease in throwing herself into a comfortable chair, an occasional absurdly inappropriate, gross, or at least ungenteel and totally incongruous expression, as though by handling bets she had absorbed some of the coarse side of the turf.
"It would not surprise me if she has taken to putting gin in her tea," he said, "and to the use of snuff."
Shortly after this the rain began to fall. The landscape vanished, and Emily went to sleep on Padine's knee. The postillion drew up to light his lamps inside the carriage, begged pardon, asked the direction again, and drove on slowly, clop, clop, clop. After a mile or so, and a shouted exchange with a farm cart, the postillion stopped again, came to the door, begged pardon, and feared they had taken the wrong lane. He would have to turn when he found a gate into a field. This happened once or twice, but not long after sunset they found themselves in the familiar, high, bare country rising to Bowram Down. The carriage drew up before the great middle door. No lights to be seen within. The little girls woke, anxious, dismayed. Padine began unstrapping the baggage. Stephen rang the bell and knocked, his heart beating high. No answer. But somewhere in the back of the house, perhaps the kitchen, a dog began to bark.
He knocked again. The queer feeling in his bosom. Pulled at the bell wire, and the bell itself could be heard ringing far inside. A light through the cracks of the door. It opened on the chain, and Clarissa's voice asked, "Who is there?"
"Stephen Maturin, my dear. I am sorry we are so late."
The chain came off with a rattle, and the door swung wide, showing Clarissa with a lantern on a table by her side and a horse pistol in her hand.
"Oh, how very glad I am to see you!"
she cried, yet with a certain embarrassment in her joy. She carefully uncocked the pistol, evidently loaded and for use, laid it on the table and held out her hand.
"Nonsense!" he cried. "We embrace!"
and kissed her.
"You have not changed,"
she said, smiling, and stood back, motioning him in. "You are alone, I doubt?" said he, not moving, but with his eyes searching the long, dark hall, and his ears on the strain.
"Yes. Yes,"
she answered hesitantly.
"Well, but for Bridget."
He went out, settled with the postboy, and came back with the little girls, Perdine following with the baggage.
"Here are some old shipmates, Clarissa," he said, leading them forward. "Sarah and Emily, you must make your bobs to Mrs. Oakes and ask her how she does."
"How do you do, ma'am?"
they said in unison.
"Very well indeed, my dears,"
she replied, kissing them. She shook Perdine's hand, and although they had not agreed very well when they sailed together in the Nutmeg, the travellers now felt much drawn to a well-known face and a familiar voice in these utterly strange and foreign surroundings. Not only was the country strange, nothing of shipboard about it, nothing of the pleasures of a port, filled with unknown people who might fly out at you, but this particular house was quite outside their experience. It was, in fact, an unusual building, tall, gaunt, and cold, one of the few large old houses that had not been altered in the last 2 centuries, so that the great hall ran right up the whole height to the roof, sombre indeed on such an evening, and by the light of a single lantern. Clarissa led them slowly, almost, as it were, reluctantly, quite through its length, and then turned right-handed into a carpeted room with candles and a fire. A small girl was building card houses on a table near the grate. Clarissa murmured, "Do not mind if she does not speak," and Stephen could feel the controlled anguish in her voice. The girl at the table was lit by the fire and 2 candles. She was 3/4 turned towards Stephen, and he saw a slim, fair-haired child, quite extraordinarily beautiful, but with a disquieting, elfin, changeling beauty. Her movements as she handled the cards were perfectly coordinated. She glanced at Stephen and the others for a moment without the least interest, almost without ceasing to place her cards, and then carried on with a 5th story.
"Come, my dear, and pay your duty to your father,"
said Clarissa, taking her gently by the hand and leading her, unresisting, to Stephen. There she made her bob, standing as straight as a wand, and with only a slight shrinking away she allowed her face to be kissed. Then she was led to the others. Their names were clearly stated. They too made their bobs, and Bridget walked easily back to her card-house, unconscious of their smiling black faces, though she did look straight up into Perdine's for a moment.
"Perdine," said Clarissa, "will you go down that long corridor now? The 1st door on your right hand."
She held up her right hand.
"Is the kitchen, and there you will find Mrs. Warren and Nelly. Please give them this note."
Stephen sat in an elbow chair, away from the light, watching his daughter. Clarissa asked Sarah and Emily about their journey, about Ashgrove, and about their clothes. They all sat on a sofa, talking away readily enough as their shyness wore off. But their eyes were fixed on the slight, wholly self-possessed, self-absorbed figure by the hearth. Mrs. Warren and Nelly took some time to appear, since they had to fetch clean aprons and caps to be presented to the doctor, the master of the house, after all. An ancient white-muzzled kitchen dog shuffled in after them, and the 1st relief to Stephen's quite extraordinary pain, extraordinary in that he had never known any of the same nature or the same intensity, came when the old dog sniffed at the back of Bridget's leg, and without stopping her left hand's delicate motion, she reached down with the other to scratch his forehead, while something of pleasure showed through her gravity. Otherwise nothing disturbed her indifference. She saw her tall card-house fall, the tottering victim of a draught, with perfect composure. She ate her bread and milk together with Emily and Sarah, unmoved by their presence, and after a good-night ceremony in which Stephen blessed her, she went off to bed with neither reluctance nor complaint. he observed with still another kind of pang that if ever their eyes met, hers moved directly on, as they might have moved on from those of a marble bust, or of a creature devoid of interest, since it belonged to a different order.
"Can she speak at all?"
he asked, when he and Clarissa were sitting at the dining table. Cold chicken and ham, cheese and an apple pie. The servants sent off to bed long since.
"I am not sure," said Clarissa. "On occasion I have heard her doing something very like it, but she always stops when I come in."
"How much does she understand?"
"Almost everything, I believe. And unless she is in one of her bad days, she is very good and biddable."
"Affectionate, would you say?"
"I like to think so. Indeed, it is probable. But the signs are hard to make out."
Stephen ate wolfishly for a while, and cutting himself another piece of cheese, he said,
"Will you tell me about Diana? I mean, what you feel you can properly say."
Clarissa looked at him doubtfully.
"I do not mean lovers or anything you cannot tell of a friend, for you were friends, I believe."
"Yes. She was very kind when Oakes was at sea, and kinder still when he was killed, although by that time it was already perfectly clear that Bridget was not like ordinary people, which distressed her extremely, so that she drank too much and might then speak wildly and be indiscreet. But she was very kind. She taught me to ride. Such joy. Very kind, and I am not an ungrateful creature, you know,"
said Clarissa, laying her hand on Stephen's arm.
"But there were reserves. I believe she was deeply convinced that I was, or had been, your mistress. When I protested my complete indifference where such matters were concerned, she only smiled politely, repeating that catchphrase, 'Les hommes, c'est difficile de s'endormir sans,' and I could not prove my point with the confidences that you so kindly listened to on that remote island when we were aboard the Nutmeg, dear ship. Confidences, I may say, that I have never made to anyone but you, and never shall. And as you and Sir Joseph advised, for the world in general, I am a governess who disliked her employment in New South Wales and ran away with a sailor."
"When do you suppose her unhappiness began?"
"Oh, very early, well before I knew her. I believe she missed you cruelly, and from what I have heard, the birth was worse than usual. An interminable labour and a fool of a man midwife. The baby was put out to nurse, of course. When it came back, it looked enchanting, and she thought she would certainly love it. But already there was this total indifference. The child wished neither to love nor to be loved. Diana had never come across anything of the kind, and she was completely bewildered as well as being wounded to the heart. When I came, I think it was some relief, but it was not nearly enough, and she grew more and more unhappy and often difficult. Her aunt Williams was very unkind indeed, I believe, and as time went on, there was no improvement in Bridget. Rather the reverse. The indifference grew to positive aversion and even to a cold dislike."
"Did any of my letters reach her?"
"None while I was here. None except that which Oakes and I brought back, of course. They would have been of the greatest help. She began to give up hope. So many ships are lost. And yet she dreaded your return, obviously. Presently she took against this house. You would not have wished her to buy it, and indeed it is cold, lonely, and inconvenient. The horses she loved almost until the end, but then suddenly she told me that she was giving up the stud, though it was quite successful, and the next week they were all sent up to Tattersall's with Mr. Wilson, the manager, all except a stallion and two mares who went into the North Country, I forget the name of the house, near Doncaster. All the grooms except for old Smith, who was to look after my little Arab and the pony and trap, were dismissed, though I know she wrote about among her friends to find new places for them, and she begged me to stay on here with Bridget until she could make arrangements. She left me a quantity of money and said she would write. I did hear from her once, in Harrogate, but not since."
"She never was a letter writer."
"No, yet she did write one that I was to give to you, should the frigate bring you home. Would you like to see it now?"
"If you would be so good."
While she was away, he rolled himself a large ball of coca leaves. Before she opened the door again, he tossed them into the fire.
"I'm sorry to have been so long," she said. "Please open it at once, if you wish. I will bring some port, if I can find it."
"Stephen," he read, "I know you loathe women who have no fortitude, but I have not the courage to bear it any longer. If you come back, if ever you come back, do not despise me."
Clarissa returned with a decanter. They neither of them spoke for a while. The rain could be heard pouring from the eaves. Eventually Stephen poured the wine, and coming back to the commonplace world, he said,
"Clarissa, I am infinitely obliged to you for staying and looking after my daughter. I must go to town with Sarah and Emily tomorrow, but if I may, I shall leave Padine here with you. Now that the house is empty, it is not fit you should be here with no more than one elderly groom. I have promised to be back at Ashgrove a week before the squadron sails, and by then I hope we can make better arrangements."
There was always Bath, he said, speaking somewhat at random, and the coast of Sussex, while Gosport offered a pleasant naval society, for really so isolated a place as Barham Down would weigh upon an angel's spirits in time. Clarissa agreed that the house itself was cold, dark, and sad, but it did have glorious rides about it. She had grown much attached to riding.
"Sure, a cheerful horse is a delightful, understanding companion," said Stephen with something of a smile. "But now, my dear, when we have drunk our port, and a very decent bottle it is, I should like to retire, if I may. Where am I to sleep?"
He heard himself utter the question. Almost immediately he saw that it might be equivocal, and his mind turned quickly in foolish circles. Clarissa remained silent, looking grave.
"I have been thinking," she said. "Nellie and I turned out Diana's room on Friday. A mouse had made her nest between one of the bedposts and the curtain, a soft round ball with five pink creatures inside. She ran off, of course, but we left the nest in a box, and when she came back I closed the lid and carried them away to the hayloft. For the moment I could not remember whether we made up the bed again, but now I am quite certain of it. New sheets and clean curtains.